As the ice and snow fell and the cold winter blew outside this week, Cambridge's arts community lit the fires of debate and convened their annual conference at Anglia Ruskin University. The whole problem of taking the economically precarious and often fragile talents of creatives in Cambridge's schools, universities and art colleges and nurturing them into successful careers in the creative industries was the focus of the session. The great need for guidance and support for artists and the potential fruits of the payback into the city's cultural life went hand in hand as key prerogatives. Cambridge Arts Network is a forum of over 1,100 professional creatives and cultural practitioners and organisations operating in the Cambridge area and is coordinated by the City Council. Entitled Embracing Potential, Pathways to Supporting and Developing Career in Native and Cultural Industries, the conference sought to debate and discuss key issues facing the sector and to share news, views and opportunities with visiting professionals. A key concern was the high level of growth in a city of 143,000 residents with 4.5 million annual visitors and the threat to the arts and cultural activity of rapid development, which doesn't necessarily respect the diverse local community. Harriet Richards, head of Cambridge School of Art, opened the proceedings and welcomed the delegates and said how important art is to happy and fulfilling lives in the city and solving its problems, and also how her goal was to produce graduates with enterprising, entrepreneurial and creative mindsets for creating innovative solutions to influence the solving of the problems of the world and to promote responsible global citizenship as a force for good. After some very positive speeches, delegates were asked to attend breakout sessions on a broad range of subjects, my own on the creative workforce and skill gaps, which looked at the demography of creative industries nationally and locally, and then had a discussion between professionals on the impact of skills gaps on each industry. The need for a basic arts degree and not to run up huge debts in early careers was seen as a major barrier to young creatives, alongside the lack of equal opportunities for those without cultural capital. Yanina Vigas, a professional storyteller from Epic Tales, says it was an engaging session.
Yanina, what does telling an epic tale involve for your organisation?
It involves working with children and young people across the country, actually, not just in Cambridgeshire, but generally working in schools and getting them really excited and engaged about stories. It doesn't involve books, it very rarely involves props, and it's a really open and pure, honest, almost dialogue between the children and the storyteller. We really worked hard to engage the children and get them involved, and it's not passive at all.
It's teaching them what's actually in a tale that's important, isn't it? Because tales can carry a massive payload of useful things, can't they?
Oh, absolutely. Quite often we have staff that come to us and say, can you tell a story that talks about bravery? Can you tell a story that talks about kindness or teaches kindness? And quite often we say, yes, we can do that. But quite often the themes that arise from the stories that the children choose, because that's very much part of what we do as well, we let the children choose what stories we tell, and very often what arises from those stories is quite often not what we are told to go and tell, but that makes the experience all the richer for it.
Okay, so it's very good for their intellectual and moral development and everything else to go through our tales and examine them and see what's in them as well, but isn't it also about self-expression skills?
It is, yeah, absolutely, and being able to experience the world in a wider form and have access to maybe some things in life that aren't quite so nice and quite so pleasant and fluffy and lovely, but to do so and experience that through the eyes of a character in the safe framework of a story.
Now, why did you come to Cambridge Arts Network Conference this year? I mean, there's lots of interesting people here doing things. Why did you come?
We came because we as an organisation have supported Cannes since the first conference, and I've come today specifically to meet other creatives in the industry and in the area and just to see who's who and what's what and where's where and who's doing what exciting work, and to see how I can network efficiently to just help us as an organisation work better within the area and ultimately increase or improve the offer of what we offer to schools.
Now we've just been jointly in one of the seminars there. We were talking about skills gaps and the demography of the arts sector. What do you feel you learned from that?
Oh my goodness, I learned that I personally live within quite a lovely creative bubble and that my eyes maybe aren't as open as they could be to the skills gaps that are in our area and in the industry as a whole. It was heartening to hear though from other creatives that a lot of people are experiencing the same issues that I am as a professional in the creative industry, and maybe we are in our organisation as well.
We also looked at the need for people competent at using state-of-the-art digital art and design tools, since as an industry it's moving forward at a fast pace with huge demand from companies and new careers await those with the skills. In the Ruskin Gallery, I encountered expert Lee Mason, a digital artist demonstrating spatial art tools working with two hands and a virtual reality headset with a large screen showing what was going on in the artistic cyberspace he was inhabiting and working within.
My name's Lee Mason. I'm a digital artist from Cambridgeshire. I'm here to showcase spatial art tools in virtual reality to gain people's feedback on today's proceedings using cutting-edge spatial design tools. So I'm basically trying to show people how intuitive and expressive virtual reality art programs are.
Okay, just for our listeners, basically standing in front of a screen with two handheld wands, effectively, and a virtual reality mask on, and you're reacting to what's going on the screen and then creating artwork from it.
Yeah, I'm painting in 3D, essentially. So I'm using something that hasn't been afforded to us at all in the history of humanity, really. There's been sculpture and there's been painting, but you've never been able to paint in thin air in three dimensions. So I'm using various different dynamic paint brushes that are creating polygons in 3D space that are viewable through my virtual reality headset. And then I can upload this so other people can view it in VR, but I can also 3D print it and bring it into the real world if I wanted to.
That's interesting because you can take a conceptual idea that would be in two dimensions and then you bring it into the 3D world and you can effectively sculpt with those, can't you?
You can sculpt, yeah, essentially you can use digital clay but without any of the restrictions of having materials or gravity or scale, things like that. Plus obviously you've got undo. You've got what it's essentially the same as a desktop 3D art program with all of the benefits you get with that, except you're inside the artwork. You've got a one-to-one relationship with that artwork. You can see it at any scale. You can zoom in and do tiny details with your whole body if you want to, so anything that would otherwise be quite hard to replicate in small details in clay can be done with very large precise movements, so you get an added level of detail to anything you create.
Now that enables you to work very quickly, doesn't it, and also to react in real time to any kind of inspiration or idea you have immediately.
That's right, yeah, it's perfect for 3D sketching. You can create spatial artwork all around you, you can create mind maps and brainstorm, and you can sketch things, and you could then export that file and you could bring it into existing desktop 3D programs to really refine it afterwards. But what you've got is a space where you are completely free of distractions and with incredibly intuitive and reactive tools that enable you to get your imagination out into the world with no barrier of entry whatsoever.
Now, this is then projected, presumably, when you get to exhibit what you've done onto a very big screen or a hologram, perhaps even.
You can bring it into augmented reality as a hologram. You can put it on a screen. You could also host a gallery exhibition in VR, so people from all over the world can put on a VR headset, walk around, wave to each other, speak to each other, hand objects back and forth, look at your artwork and buy your artwork instantly using cryptocurrency.
So digital art is moving forward in leaps and bounds by the sounds.
Absolutely. This new spatial computing interface is revolutionising it. Architects are using it to design buildings. You can walk around the building, move the sun through the sky to look at the building at different times of day, move doors and windows and edit that on the fly. Ford uses this sort of software to design their cars, so you can have someone in Tokyo and someone in London working on a car together in VR, handing things to each other. One of them could be working on the dashboard while the other one is doing the dynamic wind generation to see whether or not the car is streamlined. You could have 10 of those in in the space at once. They haven't had to get in a plane. They can just sit in their desk. They can work from home. You can use a wireless headset in a car or a train, and you can sculpt in 3D space. And then, like I say, you can send that to a large-scale 3D printer, print off rapid prototypes of a product, for instance. Or you can create something that is immersive that you can then enjoy in virtual reality. So gaming, animation, sculpture, architects, product design, car design, all of these things are being disrupted by virtual reality technology. Aside from the gaming that people are associated with, there's all sorts of things happening in studios around the world.
Does it take long to learn how to use it?
That's the beauty of it. It's easier to learn than anything. You use your body. You write and draw as if you were using a pen or a stick in the air. So you're not having to navigate your way around menus. You're not having to learn about any shortcuts. Everything in this software is in my hand. I've got a palette with hundreds of different dynamic brushes. Those brushes can be animated. They can be bubbles or stars, or they can replicate clay. I can spray clay into the air like you would sort of like shaving foam, except it's in the air and it's manipulatable afterwards. You can recolor those things. You've got millions of colors to choose from. And you can also model in 3D. You can create 3D shapes on the fly and 3D print those. So I can copy a shape, replicate it, and build up objects much more detailed than you see here.
What a tremendously dynamic and exciting tool. Thanks very much for sharing it.
No problem.
Next, we moved on to a presentation from Create Britain, an internet portal project designed to find and share everyone in the UK creative industries in an online directory with enhanced features. Connectivity is a way of remaining employed as a multidisciplinary or perhaps self-employed creative by having an attractive dynamic profile page that's plugged in nationally to people who pay. Artists get a page which shows images, video, interactive 3D, audio, an employment bio, and detailed information about them. Designed by Richard Woods, a former headhunter, with a chic showcase layout in the fashion that employers need. The site's founders claim it does the marketing for you more efficiently than the other 105 social media sites, which are not specifically fit for purpose for creatives. Founder Richard Woods and co-founder Jeremy Aird introduced the project.
Is this very much a Cambridge-based project?
It's starting in Cambridge, but no, it's definitely a national project. You know, that's one of the features of it, that we're trying to help people in Cambridge reach out to the rest of the country and also get the rest of the country looking at what Cambridge has got to offer. Because a few of us were ex-Anglia Ruskin, we tapped into the connections that we had there and they introduced us to Akua here, and she's been amazing at introducing us to all sorts of people. We spent the last 2 years building this. We've been desperately sort of holding ourselves back, wanting to throw it out into the market, but we wanted to get it right. Advantage of us being independent is that we could take our time to get it right before we start to push it out into the market.
Okay, can you paint a picture of how the website works?
Yeah, it's really two key features. One is to help you find anything and anyone in the creative industry, and also for people to promote themselves within the creative industry. You know, we have Google out there at the moment, which picks up 92% of online searches, but that doesn't work for independents and small businesses who, you know, struggle to get on the first page. And LinkedIn is okay for individuals, but a lot of creatives just don't feel any association with it.
Can you tell me about your role?
I thought about Create Britain probably about 8 years ago. And that was off the back of trying to find somewhere that I could plug in. So if you're a multidisciplinary creative, there's very few places that really are for you or understand you. And with different types of media and the different niches that creatives use and have and the skills they have, and one day they're doing music, but the next day they're doing video or designing a website or branding, there's nothing really that sort of lets them use a single platform as a launch pad to everything in their creative universe. So I can still be doing my Instagram or putting tweets out, or, you know, wherever I am, they all link back to my Create Britain profile. So if people find me on Create Britain, they find me absolutely everywhere. But the important thing is it's everywhere I want them to find me. So if you want to keep certain things private and confidential, then that is absolutely fine too. If you want to write a lot about yourself, you can. If you don't want to write anything, that's fine. If you've got video, put your video on there. If you've got music, put your music on there. Basically, put on whatever you want other people to find out about you.
We already had a vision when we started this, but because we've actually taken 2 years to get to this point, we have been out speaking to so many people, we've been in to meet groups of students, we've met, had focus groups with lots of creatives, we're talking to employees. We have actually done, I suppose, everything the textbook tells you you should do. And not a single person, not a single organisation has said, don't do this. We're talking to the BBC, we're talking to the VNA, we've got universities behind us, local authorities behind us. We've even had international organisations saying, when are you going to have this built? Because we're struggling to find the talent that UK has to offer. Yeah. You know, we've got a lot of respect for the people who do signposting within the industry, because that's what's keeping it alive at the moment. You know, I've sat in a breakout session this morning, and every time somebody would say something, everyone else say, well, what's that? How did you know about that? Well, yeah, how did you get into that? And it's all about, you know, one or two step connections. Everyone just reaches out and then just grabs whatever work is right in front of them, rather than saying, right, this is my passion. I'm going to specialise in this and I want the whole world to know about it.
Once you have all of those creatives mapped, placed on your website, advertised and everything else, what will you do with the data?
Well, this is, you know, in terms of data, we're not actually asking for any data on anyone other than what they're putting on the site. So you look at what's happening with some of the other big tech platforms and bad headlines that they've attracted. But it's funny, they spend their time trying to snoop and find out information on people, whereas we're just asking the questions up front. And people actually want to tell us. Yeah. They're telling us where they want to be found. We're not making assumptions and trying to think, you know, because they've got this type of car and they've got a dog, they must be such and such.
I mean, the question is, obviously, that data will become, if your website is a huge success, will become extremely valuable, won't it?
Well, no one's asked us really much about the revenue side of this. I mean, clearly what we've put out there now is absolutely free. It's free to register and it's free to search, and it will remain so. There will be a commercial side of the website in what we're building in these community pages. And on the community pages, you'll have a community for disciplines, you'll have a community for region. But what that means is that if Amateur Photographer magazine want to sponsor the news channel on the photography page, it's to a relevant audience. It feels like content. If Cass Arts want to be selling paints to painters, it's not offensive. It doesn't get in the way of anything. But for them, it's a very targeted audience.
Mm. How much of the design of this website was done by you, basically?
Pretty much all of it. So, yeah, love it. I definitely haven't got it all right. This is a work in progress. I've tried to look at this as, what would I look for to try and engage me? And in Britain, we have such a rich heritage of creatives, writers, sculptors, architects. We've got this amazing legacy of stuff. We've got professionals who are having a fantastic career doing stuff now, but how do we ensure that we get the next generation coming through, and then how do we build something that works at every level across discipline, nationwide, and then is also a really viable and valuable tool for us to market internationally, so that our creators are working at the highest level wherever they want to work.
Well, it sounds as though it's going to make a very big splash in the national creative pool. I hope it's a huge success. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Visiting speaker Deborah Williams, Executive Director of the Creative Diversity Network, talked on how the logical hierarchy in the arts community is being knocked sideways by populism and other movements, and new barriers to careers in the arts are arising in the world of work, since advancement is no longer necessarily based on reliable merit, track record and expertise, and it also threatens to ignore diversity. She indicated that serious artists must lean into this wind of political change and face the reality that dark times may be ahead as the world moves away from art and humanity, and that wayward adults need artists to educate them through expression into the light.
How did you find today's conference, all in all?
I enjoyed it, actually. These are the ones I tend to enjoy, because it's about people who don't necessarily think they know everything about the industry. So it was nice to sort of be around a group of people who are willing and want to learn.
You gave a rather sort of sombre account of how we were moving into something of a dark age for art and creativity. What did you mean by that?
It's connected, I guess, to the idea that expertise and experience experience don't really count for much, that people can say what they want, that anything that pops into someone's head is more valid than something that is either fact-based or is craft-based. And I think, I know a lot of artists have spent a lot of time developing their craft, and that's being dismissed as not relevant at the moment. And the space that we are currently in, sort of politically and socially and economically, means that a lot more people are likely to give up being an artist, because the barriers they're hitting are quite profound, but also you can't, not many people are seeing ways through those boundaries.
Now, you talked about leaning into it and, in a way, facing it, facing those barriers. What are the barriers, and how can people do that?
Leaning into it is trusting your craft, is trusting and believing that you are as good, frankly, as you think you are, but knowing if you're not good enough, to keep, not be ashamed or afraid to keep learning, to go back, to go away, take time out and learn more. I think a lot of the barriers, some of it is around funding at the moment. Public funding is really challenging. Whether you're in London or not, I think it's still really quite challenging. I think other some of the things that were brought up today about space to create work, space to present work, all of these things are becoming less and less available to people, which sometimes the guerrilla tactics become useful, I think. And I think the art of activism within art and artistry is something that maybe we need to bring back.
We're moving into times where there's great uncertainty. You've got this move away from professionalism, expertise, established practice, all of these other things, into this rather more Woolian, misunderstood world of new populism and so on and so forth. You were saying that children learn through play and adults learn through art. Do you think art will play a major role in educating the adult world about what the issues are in this new world?
I do believe so, and I think what's interesting is people are beginning to find that out for themselves. Yeah. And it's the plus side of the internet. Yeah. You know, we all know what the downsides are, but the plus side of the internet is, as an artist, you can create, put something on that space, and somebody will pick it up. Now, whether you get 500 or 5 million views doesn't matter, but somebody picks it up, and hopefully somebody finds a connection with it, which takes them into the next level of who they can be and who they will be. And I think the populism idea is, it's tragic because it's driven by fear, and finding artists need to find a way to enhance that fear and turn it into something, to take that fear and turn it into something completely different.
Now, some artists, obviously, in an environment like that, will want to become more radical.
Yeah.
And other artists will want to become more analytical, diplomatic, but also to make bold statements about what is actually happening, and to create artwork that changes the way people look on the world. What have you actually witnessed in your recently among artists in terms of the variety of approaches to those kind of things?
I think the biggest thing I've witnessed is what's happened at Battersea Arts Centre in London. Yeah. With Tourette's Hero, and the idea that a relaxed venue can exist. So a venue where everybody can feel welcome and find a space to be themselves, where noise isn't a problem, where all the sorts of things that usually you get told to stop doing in theatre, you are allowed to do and are able to do in theatre. I think that's at the moment a standout example. How that works is going to be something, you know, is something that will be monitored over the next 6-10 months to see what that looks like. But I think that's something radical that sits within an institution, a well-known institution, is about art, but is also about supporting the artists. And that's a way, I think, that we can start using the infrastructures that we have available in order to change and support and build against what we're being sort of funneled into and pushed into as artists.
Now, you spoke basically of a social environment that in some senses is losing its way and looking for light at the end of the tunnel or light in a further off place. Where do you think that's really going to come from?
It will come from the next generation of artists.
Yeah.
It will come from people we've not heard of yet. We don't know who they are. We don't really know they exist yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it'll be my 7-year-old nephew. It'll be someone's 5-year-old daughter. It will be... I'm hoping it will be from the Southern Hemisphere,
yeah,
as well, that it won't be from the Western world, that it will... really be from the African continent or from the Latin American continent.
And to move on to that, I mean, the art in South Africa is undergoing a massive explosion at the moment of all sorts. The Cape Town Art Fair, I was listening to someone who'd been there only the other day, and African art is really coming forward really quickly as new and original work that people actually want to buy.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that really does mean that if you have any kind of a talent and you can do this kind of portraiture, yeah, or what have you, that you can actually make money.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, if you're living in straitened circumstances in South Africa, it's a major route out of poverty.
But absolutely, and I think more African countries are beginning to understand that the cultural capital, what cultural capital is,
yeah,
and how they can use it, and how they can use it politically and economically, but socially as well. And as they be, you know, South Africa has lots of other problems going on at the moment, and it's probably one of the darkest spaces in the country's history in the last 20 years. But you're seeing artists grow. You're seeing, whether that's market theatre, whether you're seeing, you know, fine arts and visual arts, whether you're seeing fashion. All sorts of things are coming to the fore,
yeah,
and I think that's when it becomes, when you're backed up against a wall and you think that there's nothing else, all you do is you look, usually people look into themselves and go, all I've got is this,
yeah,
so I'm going to go with this because this is what I've got and this is what I know.
Is it a time for expression as well as everything,
yeah,
else?
Yeah, right. I think that's probably it. You know, the time for the artist, but also the time for expression. And most of us, most artists are shut down in our expression with the usual routes.
Yeah.
So you go back to what you know. You go back to making art. You go, yeah, back to writing, drawing, painting, cutting cloth, and beginning to say, and just showing it and putting, placing it out there.
Thank you very much indeed.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
Artists Eleanor Breeze and Denise Kill talked on their latest series, Motion Sickness, and a breakout session which looked at ways of accommodating artists in a city that's expanding and the interests of developers conflicting with artists' space needs.
So Motion Sickness, we are a group of three artists that met in Cambridge and we formed a collective to make some work together. And since August last year, we've got hold of a unit through the Line Yard. We're supported by the Line Yard. And that's Motion Sickness Project Space, which is where we program a series of exhibitions from local and national artists.
Now, we saw some great pieces there. Obviously, the man who had two lower halves stuck together. who did that one?
That was from that was by Will, and I can't pronounce his surname. Will
Van Botersen.
Van Botersen. And he is one of the artists. He graduated from ARU as well.
There was another great piece. I mean, I saw a number of pieces by yourself. You tell me a few about those. But there was also an electric chair, wasn't there? So what was that about?
Oh, that was an ARU student, actually. So they, when was, that was our exhibition back in December, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a very popular piece at our exhibition for sure. That was quite an eye-catching one.
So there's a couple of eye-catchers now. What were your pieces in the beginning?
My work, well, the very first show that we had back in August, I had some work in that, and I do everything from digital prints to sculpture to video work. So yeah, I had lots of bits and pieces.
And what kind of responses have you been getting from people?
Very positive, very positive. People are just happy to see art space in Cambridge. You know, there's so many disused spaces that, you know, have no purpose. So we're glad to be filling them and giving them purpose again and function.
Ellie, what was your work all about?
So I did a piece about Amber Rose, the what does she do? She's a kind of social media public figure, isn't she? So that was kind of around feminism and whether it's useful to have people that are kind of posing their bodies naked on for the sake of feminism. Is that helpful? So something around that. And then some sculptural pieces as well.
There was a thing with some heads, wasn't there?
Yeah. So heads of people that I used to date. Yeah, which is just kind of like a jokey thing around the artist muse kind of theme.
What's that piece called?
It was called Delusions of Grandeur.
Delusions of Grandeur about people who used to date.
Yes.
Now, what's brought you to the Cambridge Artists Network conference this time?
So we've been invited along to take part in a panel around creative infrastructure in Cambridge because we're doing this thing with the space, the empty spaces. I suppose what we want to be saying is that more people should be doing this. More artists should be getting in touch with landlords, and even if it's just temporarily occupying spaces.
Do you think there's a need to kickstart the public artwork scene in Cambridge again? Because it seems to have kind of stalled to a certain amount. I know a lot of that's got to do with a cut in funding, but also the lack of energy
that there's been recently. I mean, motion sickness was a great bucking the trend in terms of, because there used to be masses of those things going on in Cambridge, and it does need kick-starting again, don't you think?
Yes, 100%. And I think the artists of Cambridge need to mobilise and get active in pursuing space.
Now, what was your talk on?
So the talk is more like a panel, and it was about discussing how, as Cambridge is expanding, how we can make sure that creativity is kept at the core of that. And obviously that involves making sure there's space for artists, but the trouble is around obviously making it financially viable for the developers and stuff like that. I think there's a bit of a conflict of interest at the moment. And I suppose we were there from the point of view of artists that are doing stuff at ground level, just grassroots stuff.
Right. Now, who were the other members of the group, and what did they say? What were they saying?
So it was Michelle Lord from Cambridge City Council, I think, and David from South Cambridge. And they're both talking about what the councils are doing to work with landlords and businesses to kind of make more space for artists. But
now, what kind of problems are artists actually suffering from in 2020 in order to get themselves off?
It's tricky to... So there's space, because space, especially in a city like Cambridge, it's so expensive, and so landlords don't. It's not worthwhile. They can get more money developing buildings into homes and properties to let rather than using them as studios. So it's difficult to find space, and then it's also difficult to find space to show in, which is why we're so lucky with the Lion Yard, able to show exhibitions from artists. That's a really important part of our practice. And
now, a great number of the artist studios that were purpose built, you know, that lasted since the 60s, have recently been taken out of circulation, turned into luxury flats, all that kind of stuff. That must be a trend that must be quite worrying if you're on the breadline and trying to get something together.
It is. It's really frustrating that that's being prioritised, and that, you know, money kind of can defeat the arts. But I think we're relentless, and I think the arts will keep going regardless of what barriers we face, but it would be very good for us to be able to obtain more landmass for sure.
Great. Okay, so what exhibitions are coming up soon with you two?
So we've got the Cambridge Wide Open, which is we put out an open call to Cambridge artists, and that will be open from the 5th of March, or it opens in the evening on the 5th of March, and then it'll be open until the 22nd of March, and that'll be loads of, about 40 local artists.
It's actually relaunching Motion Sickness, so we're moving to a new location at Unit 46 at the Lion Yard, so it will be a really exciting event, and you should definitely come.
Okay, dates for that?
So it opens on the 5th from 6 till 9 p.m, and then it will be open Wednesdays from 5 till 8 and Fridays to Sunday from 11 till 4 p.m. until the 22nd of March.
Thank you both very much for sparing us some time to talk to us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
The City Council has long-term plans to factor in the provision of facilities for the arts into the city's future programme, and also to link arts development to wider issues in the community. People with issues or in recovery, or who need creativity for personal development as well as work. Art has been identified as an important way out of crippling social problems, but the lack of places to do it is becoming a problem. Here's City Council Culture and Community Manager Jane Wilson.
How's this year's conference been for you, and how does it compare with previous years?
It's been a really good day. It's always excellent to get the kind of collective thinking of the creative sector in the city for a day, and today it was no different, and really nice to focus on how we support the next generation into creative careers. The council has a real commitment to ensuring that everyone benefits from all of the opportunities that are available in the city, and that means all our young people. So our role is an important part of what we do, is to make sure that everyone growing up and living and working in the city can benefit from what's here.
Faithfully recording the conference proceedings were illustrators from Cambridge School of Art, getting some hands-on practice in real-time mapping of the event in progress visually with drawings. Here's Diana and her friends from the graphic design degree course.
My name is Diana, and I'm a third-year graphic designer, and I'm doing graphic recording for the Cannes conference.
So tell me a little bit about what your task here is today.
My task is to translate what is being said onto a visual way using very simple graphic language and text. So basically just condense everything that's being discussed in one piece of paper in a way that everyone can understand visually.
Now this is an art form which is actually becoming extremely popular, isn't it?
I'm not quite sure whether it's really popular or not. I've only done it twice. I didn't know it actually existed until the first time I did it last year. But apparently, Akua said earlier that there is quite a demand for it. It's just that it's within like conference kind of aspect of things, which I don't really attend to lots of those, so I'm not experienced enough to say whether it's popular or not.
Do you have to work very fast?
Work
very fast.
Yeah, you have to do it as they speak. So yeah, you do have to do it quite quickly.
Yeah, are you pleased with the result?
Yes, yeah. So far we've done really good work today. I'm really pleased.
Great. What's your name?
My name's Abby Turner. I do digital media, but I'm also being a graphic recordist for Cannes.
Have you been actually travelling around and enjoying the conference as well as doing all the drawing?
We've been able to sit in on quite a few of the talks. We haven't done any of the breakout sessions, but we saw a talk on the Creative Britain and then the introductory speeches as well as this coming one now.
And what did you get out of that?
A lot of useful information actually about the creative world and how it's sort of evolving, especially networking opportunities available to us now.
Yeah, great. I'm looking forward to seeing the finished product.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, what's your name?
My name's Jay, and I'm a second year illustration student.
So what have you actually been drawing yourself?
So we've essentially been interpreting the lectures and using our own visual language to kind of create a visual representation of what the lectures have been talking about.
How does visual language work?
It's a lot of listening more than drawing, really. Trying to catch all the key points and condense them into simple icons that the viewers can understand better.
And have you enjoyed doing that?
Yeah, it's been really fun. This is my second year doing it.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The findings of the day were a series of new messages from the panel. People who've made it in the arts should share the journeys they went on to become a successful creative and let other people know who supported them. Artists should let people know how challenging work experience can be to break into the creative industries so that they can plan a career. Artists in Cambridge need to mobilise and fight for space. The need for equal opportunities for people with our cultural and economic capital and cultural entitlement for everyone in the city should be a right. For artists to have faith in an industry and fight for a rich cultural and creative future. That you need passion to make a creative career work and some realistic marketing help, and that having your say can in fact damage your employability. Delegates asked the City Council to ask the upper echelons of the Cambridge community to fund the arts more, and also to centralise resources and establish good practice, to found apprenticeships in creative industries, and to foster relationships for empty arts spaces for arts projects. Although there was plenty more, people left having generated new enthusiasm, and the arts in Cambridge are set to bounce back this summer with a good number of public arts projects. More on those in the coming weeks. All in all, it was a day well worth participating in. I'm Simon Burton. You're listening to Cambridge 105.